This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last week's attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon are part of a decade-long holy war against the United States. Earlier attacks include the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993, the bombing of American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998, and a thwarted plan to bomb New York landmarks, including the United Nations and the Lincoln and Holland tunnels. My guest Benjamin Weiser covered the embassy bombing trial this year. Four men were found guilty of all the charges against them. Weiser also covered the 1997 trial that convicted Ramzi Ahmed Youssef of directing the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. Benjamin Weiser covers the federal court in Manhattan for the New York Times. I spoke with him this morning. The embassy bombing trial wrapped up in August. And you wrote that the closing arguments for the trial sounded like the opening argument in a future trial of bin Laden, if he's ever captured. Would you sum up some of the things that were said in that closing argument?
Well, in the closing arguments of the embassy bombings case in New York, of course, the government was trying to convict, and eventually did convict, four of bin Laden's associates who were on trial. But in order to do so, they had to prove to the jury satisfaction that he, bin Laden, had led and participated with these men in a global terrorism conspiracy to kill Americans abroad and everywhere around the world, as the government put it. And that really put bin Laden on trial in a way, too. He was not tried in absentia. He has not yet been tried, and the government did not try to prove evidence against him. But they clearly had to show that this conspiracy existed, so that they could then show that the four men on trial were members of it. So I suspect we would hear many of the same kinds of arguments and pieces of evidence in a trial in the future if bin Laden was ever put on trial in New York. And I suspect we would see a number of the same witnesses.
So how close did the embassy bombings trial come to tying bin Laden to the bombings? And what were the convicted men's ties to bin Laden?
The four men who went on trial had various ties to bin Laden, some weaker than others. One of the men, and probably the man the government felt was the highest-ranking man in his organization of the four on trial, was an American citizen named Wadi El-Haj from Texas, who the government claimed had been his personal secretary and a close aide, in addition to being an operative who traveled around the world, helped to make false passports, helped to set up corporate fronts for bin Laden in Kenya. At another level, some of the operatives were what you would perhaps describe as much lower members, but who played the role of suicide bombers in the Nairobi attack, although the one on trial did not, in fact, die, and a man who helped deliver the bomb in the Tanzania attack. The fourth man on trial was also an associate who was a member of al-Qaeda, the group run by bin Laden, as the government says, and was also involved in the Nairobi case. So those were the four. In addition to the evidence produced at trial, in a hearing before the trial, the government took a plea from another man who had worked for bin Laden named Ali Muhammad, who, interestingly, was a former American Army sergeant who had served at Fort Bragg, but had also gone to work for bin Laden and his conspiracy. And in that hearing, which took place somewhat before the embassy bombings case began, this was last October, Ali Muhammad said that as early as 1993, he had actually gone to Kenya to surveil American targets for possible bombings at the request of bin Laden, and while there, took photographs and other surveillance of the American embassy in Nairobi. Then he said he went back to bin Laden and showed him his file, and bin Laden pointed to where a truck bomb might drive. Looking at the photographs, that's actually the closest that they've ever tied bin Laden to the embassy bombing in Nairobi, although they did not actually put that evidence into the trial itself.
I'm wondering if there's anything you see in last week's attacks that seemed to connect, in terms of method or technique, to the embassy bombings, the trial that you covered. You know, for example, I think in that trial, at least one of the men went to flight school in the United States.
That's right. It's very early in this investigation to make the links that people are making, and they, of course, may be true. We haven't yet seen much of the evidence that the government's collecting that would link this to bin Laden, and if that's the case. But there were a number of things that surfaced in the embassy bombings trial that will really help people understand if this is a bin Laden operation, you know, how it happened. In addition to the fact, as you've just pointed out, that a number of there was evidence in the trial of several of bin Laden's operatives going to flight school in the United States and learning pilot techniques. There was also a great deal of evidence that surfaced in the trial that, to some extent, shows how bin Laden's modus operandi has worked and that of his organization. And we've seen that again in this case. It appears that, you know, a small number of what they call cells or groups of 4 to 5 people were involved in each of the hijacking of the planes, and perhaps receiving support from a larger network on the ground in the U.S. And this is very characteristic, at least the testimony showed in the last trial, of how the organization that he runs works. There was a manual introduced in the trial, a terrorism manual, as it was described, in which the government literally showed that bin Laden's group had instructed agents to work in small cells to ensure their security and safety, almost compartmented so that no member of any cell would know what other cells were involved in doing, both to protect their own security and the security of the other cells.
What else did you learn about how the cells operate?
The cells were almost hierarchical in structure, at least based on the evidence in the trial. Again, they involved very few people, and each cell was a representative of a different task. Some of the cells would do after an idea was thought up, one cell would do the surveillance of targets, as Ali Mohammed had himself in the Kenya case. Others would plan the operation, and then others would actually carry out the actual attack, and yet others would clean up afterwards and help in the escape. And it was all written down in these manuals. As we mentioned in a recent article in the Times, on page 12 of one of the manuals, under missions required, was a particular section that talked about the blasting and destroying of embassies and attacking vital economic centers. So it's interesting in retrospect as well.
So do the targets come from the top of the organization, or do the cells even decide on who the target is?
The evidence suggests that the ideas do flow from the top, and that they are, the targets are picked at the highest levels. But there's also evidence that the cells can operate on their own once they're activated. In one of the documents that surfaced in the embassy bombings case, this fellow Ali Mohammed, who again acted as a kind of logistics expert for bin Laden and later pleaded guilty and talked in court a little bit about what he had done, described the placing of hundreds of terrorists known as sleepers or submarines, as they described it, who would lie low for years until they were activated. And there's one document described Ali Mohammed's comment that trained terrorists don't order their people to blow things up. Terrorists are trained and then they act. And the characteristic of the operations is long planning and advanced surveillance and meticulous preparation, which could take years and years. And as we saw, the embassy bombings in Kenya were planned at least as early as 1993, according to the testimony from Ali Mohammed, which was 5 years before. And that might suggest that today's bombing was planned 4 or 5 years ago, you know, somewhere in the world.
Yeah, the submarines or sleepers, as they were described, these are operatives who are put into place, for instance, sent to the United States, and they just wait there until they're activated, until they're called to work.
That's right. And again, the evidence is extremely scant so far, but it appears that a number of the people who are being identified as suspects in this hijacking case were in the United States for several years, undergoing their training and their schooling and melding into the community with nothing to do except wait.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Benjamin Weiser. He covers the federal court in Manhattan for the New York Times. He covered the trial of Ramzi Ahmed Youssef, who was convicted of masterminding the World Trade Center bombing of 1993. And Weiser also covered the trial of the embassy bombings, and that trial wrapped up in August. Did you learn anything at the trials that you covered about recruiting of terrorists?
One thing the trial showed was that bin Laden wanted to recruit Americans, and did, because of the ease with which they could travel around the world with their American passports. In the embassy bombings case, at least two or three Americans surfaced. One was the fellow Wadi Ahaj, who was a naturalized American citizen who had worked for bin Laden and was ultimately convicted. Ali Mohammed, the sergeant I mentioned, was also a naturalized American citizen from Egypt.
You know, I've been reading in a couple of articles in the New York Times, in fact, that the profile of the suicide bomber seems to be changing. That, you know, for a while, the suicide bombers seemed to be people who were young, pretty poor, pretty disenfranchised, not very well educated, ready to give their lives in part because there probably weren't a whole lot of options for them. But now some of the suicide operatives seem older. Some of them have families. Some of them are fairly well schooled, and they don't seem to be in the dire straits that the suicide bombers were thought to be in. Do you have any observations about that?
It of course is an important question, because if we can't anticipate the profile of the bomber, it's going to be very hard to find them before they act. Again, Ali Mohammed in the embassy bombings case said that the United States was hampered in a comment he made to the FBI, was hampered in its efforts to stop terrorism, specifically because the profiles it uses to identify potential terrorists are flawed. And also, the embassy bombings trial showed that the people who worked for this organization specifically sought to change their appearance, even in ways that might make them look, you know, less Muslim, shaving their beards, not wearing traditional Muslim dress, specifically so that they would not fit the more physical descriptive profile at the time that they're moving.
You know, your reporting has described the terrorist network as meticulous in its planning, but you wrote, on the other hand, the embassy bombing trial showed that bin Laden's group was at times slipshod, torn by inner strife, betrayal, greed, and the banalities of life. What are some examples that came up in the trial?
Well, the most dramatic example was the emergence of one of Mr. bin Laden's former top aides, a fellow named Jamal al-Fadl, who ultimately broke with bin Laden and eventually worked his way into the hands of the United States, pled guilty, and became perhaps the most important witness in the trial for the government. I also believe he'll be perhaps the most important witness, one of them certainly, if Mr. bin Laden or other top members of his organization are arrested. And he left bin Laden after stealing money from him because he felt that he was being underpaid and that bin Laden was favoring certain members of his group over others, feeling that the Egyptian members were getting paid better and treated better. Although this ultimately had no effect on the operational capacity of bin Laden, it did allow the United States government, I believe, to see that there were, you know, like every organization, some vulnerabilities that could be exploited. And the government ultimately presented two very important, what they call accomplice witnesses at the trial, people who had worked for bin Laden and left him over some disagreement.
My guest is Benjamin Weiser. He covers the federal court in Manhattan for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is New York Times reporter Benjamin Weiser. We're looking at what we learned from earlier terrorist attacks. Weiser covered the U.S. Embassy's bombing trial this year. He also covered the 1997 trial related to the first attack on the World Trade Center. Now, you covered the 1997 trial of the World Trade Center bombing, the one that convicted Ramzi Ahmed Youssef. Just sum up what that trial was about for us to refresh our memory. Like, who was on trial on this one?
In the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, of course, initially a trial was held the same year of four men who had been arrested for actually carrying out the operation. By 1997, the government had also arrested two other men, Youssef, who was largely described as the man who led the operation, and a second man who had driven the truck into the basement garage of the World Trade Center, which carried the bomb. Youssef was convicted in that case, as was the other man, and was ultimately sentenced to prison for the rest of his life. It was an interesting trial because Youssef, at the end of the case, when he was sentencing, got up and gave a speech in the courtroom in which he tried to explain why he had acted and actually did not hide the fact that he was a terrorist. He said, I am a terrorist and I am proud of it, he said. The judge at the time, Kevin Duffy, who's a veteran judge in Manhattan and also somewhat of a scholar of the Quran himself, also talked and accused Youssef of really betraying his religion. I'm looking at the quote. Duffy said, "It wasn't honor or the glory of God or Allah that Ramzi Youssef took away from the Afghanistan war where he had fought. But it was his enjoyment of death, particularly the death of innocent people, and as he put it, your adoration of the cult of death. And Yusuf complained at one point that he hadn't been allowed to make phone calls to his family, and the judge said, you know, we don't even know what your real name is. And since Yusuf had used dozens of aliases, and the judge said, having abandoned your family name, I must assume that you've abandoned your family also. So they got into quite a back and forth. You know, there's also information that Yusuf, after his arrest in 1995, as he was being brought back to New York by the FBI in a helicopter that was flying over mid-Manhattan and bringing him to detention before he would be actually placed on trial, that he looked out the window and saw the World Trade Center towers, you know, standing glowing in the city's night, and one of the FBI officials said, "Look down there; they're still standing." And Yusuf replied, "They wouldn't be if I had had enough money and explosives."
Yeah, in fact, you said that this FBI agent quoted Yusuf as saying that he hoped the explosion would have toppled one tower onto the other, killing tens of thousands of people to let Americans know they were at war. It's really terrifying to read that that's what he wanted back in 93.
There's no question that's what Yusuf wanted.
So let's back up a bit. You said that at the 97 trial, Ramzi Yousef said, you know, I am a terrorist. What did he say to explain why?
This, of course, was not at the trial itself. Just to clarify, he did not testify on his own behalf. But when he was sentenced, before sentencing, everybody has an opportunity to explain themselves. And the judge gave Yusuf an opportunity to explain himself. Mm-hmm. And Yusuf said, to summarize it, you know, in his short talk, he attacked the United States and Israel, the peace process. He described what he called the Jewish lobby, which he contended had paid bribes to American officials to win their influence. He said, quote, "This is what you worship, money. Money is your God. Hypocrisy is your courier." That was Yusuf talking. Judge Duffy later said back to him, quote, "Death was truly your God, your master, your one and only religion." The judge said, he told Yusuf, "You claim to be an Islamic militant. Of all the persons killed or harmed in some way by the World Trade Center bomb, you cannot name one who was against you or your cause. You did not care, just so long as you left dead bodies and people hurt." And, of course, six people were killed in the first World Trade Center bombing. More than 1,000 were hurt. That number is very small, of course, compared to this past week.
Many terrorist experts have said that even if we do get bin Laden, the terror network would likely continue to exist, that by getting rid of bin Laden, you haven't destroyed the network. Did you learn anything at the trials you covered about the other powerful people who are perhaps as number two or number three who might be ready to take over if he's captured?
There was a great deal of evidence about his organization, who were his high-ranking aides, what their nationalities were and how they operated. There was no indication necessarily that these high-level aides had access to the same kinds of money or even were able to inspire followers the way bin Laden did. And I think it just seems to me to be too early to say precisely, you know, who might take his place. But it doesn't seem likely to me that when the United States says that it wants bin Laden handed over, that it means it only wants bin Laden handed over. I have to assume that they're asking for bin Laden and many of his closest aides.
Given the kind of training and ideology and religious fervor behind the terrorists, is it harder for the government to turn terrorists into witnesses?
You know, it's actually sort of it's a difficult question to answer, but I think the evidence shows that even with the intense dedication that bin Laden's followers gave to him and his organization, that ultimately the government was able to turn at least two people who were presented at trial. Ali Mohammed, his former top aide, did not testify, but obviously provided a lot of information to the government and pleaded guilty. And there were other lower-level people who testified and had pleaded guilty. So the evidence is there that they were able to do it, and I have no doubt that they'd be able to do it again. But it's clear that the government has to you know, look hard for these people, and I'm sure it's a combination of luck and skill and good investigative work to find them. I think some come to us and some we find.
What's the incentive that a terrorist might have to turn and become a government witness?
In the case of Al-Fadl, Jamal Al-Fadl, who until the trial had been described in a very mysterious way as CS1 for Confidential Source 1, and ultimately became the major government witness, you know, against bin Laden, he ultimately was on a run for his life. He left bin Laden, as I mentioned, after stealing some money from him, getting into a financial dispute, and ultimately left. He ultimately ended up in the hands of the United States for his own protection. And I think a lot of people who might be recruitable by the United States, at least in the sense of participating as government witnesses, may fit that category.
Benjamin Weiser covers the federal court in Manhattan for the New York Times. Our interview was recorded earlier today. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.